Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, and I'm the director of Northwestern University's Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. In the month of August 2005, and again in August 2007, the United States experienced major infrastructure failures in New Orleans and in Minneapolis that stunned the country with their traumatic loss of life and drew the attention of the world.
The New Orleans levees and flood walls were a complex system built by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in stages beginning in 1965. The I-35W bridge was completed in 1967. The causes of these failures were many: inadequate maintenance and inspection, vulnerable design, construction issues, as well as unexpected changes in loadings that exceeded the margin of safety. These are problems that appear to be common to many key infrastructure components today.
So today we're going to talk about structural failures of civil infrastructure: roads, bridges, levees, dams, utility structures, and buildings. How common are they? And what can we learn from them? Joining us to discuss this important topic is Henry Petrosky. He's professor in the Pratt School of Engineering at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, where he specializes in failure analysis. Dr. Petrosky has written more than a dozen books. He's a columnist for the American Scientist magazine and is a frequent lecturer on engineering topics. He's a registered professional engineer and a member of the National Academy of Engineering. Professor Petrosky, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Can you give us a better definition of the meaning of structural failures and give us a sense of whether there are lots of big failures or whether more subtle failures are more common?
Well, I think the more subtle failures are definitely more common. The reason the big catastrophic collapses make the news is precisely the fact that they aren't that common. But every now and then, bridge parts break, parts that are not, say, the weakest link, that aren't critical, and the bridge doesn't collapse. But these things have to be paid attention to, of course, or else eventually the bridge will continue to have small structural failures and eventually a large one. There's a bridge in Maine, for example. It was a suspension bridge that the inspection found some of the wires in the cables. The suspension bridge cables are made up of many, many wires, and they discovered that some of those wires over the half century or so that the bridge had been in operation had broken, had been corroded. Well, that, of course, weakens the structure because it doesn't have as many of the wires that it was designed to have. And there was quite a concern about how safe the bridge was, so they began to limit its access to trucks and so forth. That was not a dramatic failure. Nobody driving over that bridge would have really noticed anything other than a bunch of workmen trying to do something. But things like that really have to be paid attention to.
And as you look across the spectrum of failures, are there certain contributing causes that are seen more frequently than others?
Generally, yes. The design is often blamed as a cause of failure. Typically, if a design is poor, that will show up very early. So a lot of early failures, meaning that the structure is not that old, tend to be design failures. On the other extreme is a structure that's been in service for a long time. There, the on and off loading and unloading of traffic, and or if it's a train bridge, whatever, leads to what's called metal fatigue. This is a very insidious phenomenon. The small cracks grow very, very slowly, and over literally millions, tens of millions of cycles, they grow to the point where the structure can no longer hold itself together. And those failures are fairly common also. Generally speaking, maintenance is also a big cause of failures, neglected maintenance in particular. Steel bridges have to be painted every now and then, primarily to protect the steel against corrosion. Neglecting that, of course, means that you're not keeping the corrosion down, and some bridges in New York City in particular years ago had holes developing in them because they were rusting so badly.
Can you give us a sense of what happens at different stages of the life cycle of a structure? I wonder if some structures are at greater risk when they're under construction. The Miller Field, the baseball stadium in Milwaukee, where there was a crane accident in 1999, is an example. And then we can contrast that with what happened with the I-35W bridge, which was 40 years into its life cycle when that failure occurred.
Yes, construction failures are very very common, actually. When a structure is under construction, it tends to be subjected to some of the most severe loads and conditions that it will ever see. If it's an incomplete structure, for example, and while it's under construction, it generally is, it doesn't have all of the structural components that it's designed to have eventually. So it's a very critical time. Generally speaking, however, if a structure does survive construction, it's pretty safe, pretty reliable. The Minneapolis Bridge is an interesting case because, as you point out, you know, it was in service for quite a while, about 40 years, and it appears that there was not as careful an inspection of that bridge over the years as there should be of any structure. Things were missed really probably should not have been missed, in particular some bent steel plates that connected some of the steel components together. These things are in litigation still, I believe. That only happened, about 3 years ago. So the full story of that bridge is still not in.
But that's an interesting case because, as I understand it, one of the contributing factors was a design error, an under-design of one of the gusset plates that was smaller than it needed to be.
That's right. The so-called gusset plates are means of joining together a whole bunch of these different steel parts that come in at different angles. And the steel plates that was found were about a half inch thick when they should have been a whole inch thick, as I recall. But a structure like a bridge is designed with what's called a factor of safety, which means that it's deliberately designed to be much stronger than it has to be. So even if those plates were a half of the thickness they should have been, they still obviously were able to hold the bridge up for 40 years. So it appears in that Minneapolis bridge case that perhaps there were other contributing factors. Why did the bridge fail when it did, if it had stood for 40 years, even with the weaker plates? One explanation appears to be that the bridge was about to be resurfaced, and there was a lot of equipment, heavy equipment, paving equipment, parked on the bridge in one of the closed lanes, and also there was a lot of heavy gravel, that was piled up in those lanes ready to be used in the resurfacing project. So there was this combination of having a bridge that did have some weak parts, and then it was, in addition, overloaded by this construction equipment and material.
Is it fairly common, in your experience, to find that at least the major structural failures have multiple causes?
Yes, definitely. That's a sort of a rule of thumb that if you have an accident and you go looking for causes, you don't look for just one. You look at what else might have been happening at the time, and because the question is always why did the failure happen when it did? Because typically these structures have withstood the rigors of construction. They have stood for years, if not decades. So there has to be something that happened, and that usually isn't just the design of the structure, because, as I've said, that had lasted. And there usually are some mitigating circumstances.
And you mentioned in the case of the Minneapolis Bridge that it's still in litigation. Are there things that are known then to the litigants in terms of details of the failure that won't be known to someone like yourself that studies failures in general until the thing is open in court?
Well, it's possible that there are things that haven't come out. And sometimes when these cases go to court, the records are sealed, the decision is sealed. But generally, the information gets around to the community, to the people that are interested in this stuff in an informal way.
That was my thought, because information like that actually would be critical for people to know going forward.
So that brings up an interesting issue, because I talked to other people in the field, particularly structural researchers, who are very concerned about these outcomes where there's a court case and litigation ends with the record being sealed so that there is no learning going forward. Is there a role for the engineering profession or perhaps the government to step in and make sure that we maximize learning from these experiences?
Yes, generally speaking, I would say that's the case. In the Minneapolis Bridge, for example, it's the National Transportation Safety Board was in charge of the investigation, and that board is in charge of all transportation-related failures, collapses, accidents. They are not likely, as a government body, to withhold any crucial information. So a lot of this information does come out before the court case. And of course, if you know what the cause is before it even goes to court, then that's not really a big issue. The fact of the matter is that a lot of the things that happen in court are generally related to fine points that of the law rather than of design or engineering. Things like, well, who is responsible? For example, in the Minneapolis case, the bridge was designed by an engineering firm 40 or so years ago that is no longer in existence. But in the meantime, that company had been bought by another company. So the question is that company, that successor company, liable for the bad design that was done by the original company? That's the kind of issue that will be discussed in court. And that doesn't really withhold any technical information.
In your book, To Engineer as Human, The Role of Failure in Successful Design, you point out that behind engineering successes lie a trail of instructive but subtle engineering failures. Can you give us some examples of major infrastructure failures that led to particularly valuable new insights or methods or designs?
Well, what I was alluding to there in part was the design process itself. In the course of designing a structure, a bridge, or a building, one of the chief responsibilities of the engineer is to think about how it might fail, what could go wrong, especially if it's an unusual structure. And as a result, the engineer, either at the computer or at the drawing board, is really going through failure scenarios. And so this thought process is really rooted in failure. And so that's part of the illusion there. But sure, in real world too, when something is off the drawing board and in the construction phase, little things happen. Maybe during construction, some things will be breaking that weren't expected to. That's a clear signal that obviously something is wrong, or some floors or parts of a bridge or a building might be more flexible than expected. Responsible people will say, you know, we really should stop and look at this and ask why this is happening. And more often than not, an error will be caught that there was a miscalculation or something was overlooked and the thing will be beefed up or changed. There are a lot of changes that happen during the construction process. And these things generally aren't known publicly, but they're obviously known to the people involved.
When you think about the failures or subtle or major that occurred during the construction process, does the movement in the direction of more design-build contracting, is that likely to reduce those failures where you have the designer and the builder literally one entity?
The designer and builder being one entity means that there's going to be less litigation in holding up the project, because in the more conventional way, where there's a separate designer and a separate builder, if the builder encounters a problem, the builder will blame the designer, and they might, you know, construction might stop while they argue it out, possibly even in court. So if the same company or the same firm is both the designer and the builder, well, they'd be fighting with themselves. So they are more inclined to settle issues between the design part and the build part of the firm, if you will, amicably, and get on with the project, because the bottom line is going to be affected if they don't.
Do you think that major civil infrastructure failures are becoming more or less common? Where is the U.S. positioned on this learning curve?
Well, that's a good question. We have an aging infrastructure, as you know, we hear very often, but certainly our infrastructure isn't as old as Europe's or some other parts of the world. At the same time, our infrastructure is older than countries that are very conscientious about keeping up their infrastructure. So I'd say we're somewhere perhaps in the middle in terms of the age of our infrastructure and therefore the learning curve. What we don't seem to have learned so well is not the technical aspects of it, but rather the public policy aspects, I might say, that not realizing that we have to spend money to the government has to spend money to keep the infrastructure up, to modernize it, to replace it when necessary. There have been a lot of examples in the past year of water mains breaking, for example, and in cities like New York and elsewhere around the country, some of the water mains that are buried in the ground are, of the order of a century old. These things were not designed initially to last that long. So there should have been proactive replacement of these piping systems, for example. It's it's like owning a car. You have to expect to do certain maintenance. You have to change the oil every now and then, or you do more harm to the machine.
It's an interesting problem because the expectation is that the policymakers understand this and allocate the resources to maintaining to put into the care and feeding of infrastructure, and yet I think people have a tendency to walk past that infrastructure and think it's going to last forever without any kind of maintenance.
Well, that may be what people think, but it just doesn't happen that way. An engineer, say, designing a bridge, has to have in mind how long that bridge is supposed to last, whether it be 50 years or 75 years or 100 years, and explicitly make calculations based on that. I talked about fatigue earlier, where cracks grow over time. That's one of the principal calculations that a bridge engineer would do in the course of design. So bridges, in particular, have a design life. And everything basically has a design life, meaning what was thought it would last. This is important in how you choose the materials. What kind of materials do you choose? Some materials last longer than others. So up front, having this concept of how long the structure is supposed to last affects how long it will last, not surprisingly.
And you had mentioned that there are some countries that do a better job in maintenance. And I assume there's a political difference because, it's hard here in the United States, can be hard to get money for anything, especially in this economy. How do those countries function politically that seem to do a better job than the United States does of recognizing the importance of infrastructure and investing in it?
Well, they take a longer view generally. They take a bigger picture view. The Netherlands is famous for having defenses against the sea. The dikes, the gates that they put up against sea rise and so forth. And they think in terms literally of thousands of years, that if they're going to build something, they think of it as working for the next 1,000 years possibly with necessary maintenance along the way. And they think in terms of risk-benefit very much also. They say, well, if we don't do this, we risk having all this farmland flooded or having this city flooded. They realize that not only means that there's going to be a flood and probably loss of life, but it also means it's going to have a terrible effect on the economy of the country, and it's not that large a country, so maybe that's why they tend to think more globally about their country. It's more easily grasped not only what the implications of a failure could be, but also how those implications are more than just technical.
And with the political difficulty in this country of getting money dedicated to infrastructure maintenance and improvements, combined with the tightness of budgets these days, do you look for major infrastructure failures to become more common going forward?
I think that's the most likely thing that to expect. There was a lot of talk about 2 years ago of you know, spending money on infrastructure as stimulus to the economy and so forth, but I personally haven't seen it, and I think the construction industry generally hasn't seen it. There has been money spent. There's a lot of visible repaving of roads and streets, but that's short-term stuff. That's not real big-picture thinking. That's not long-term thinking.
Do you think advances in new designs and particularly new materials are likely to make structures safer, more robust, more longer lasting?
Well, generally, yes. New materials, but also, however, introduce new uncertainties in some cases. Here, if we're talking about trying to build, and again, let's use bridges as the example, something that lasts 50 or 75 or 100 years, if we're going to use new materials that have only been around, let's say, a decade or so, there's a big uncertainty there about whether those materials will last that long. Some materials might be affected by just the mere fact of being out in the sunlight that long. They might deteriorate for that reason. So new materials are a two-edged sword in a certain sense.
Yeah, and it presents a problem because accelerated testing can be impossible in some circumstances.
That's right. Accelerated testing is always suspect, or can be suspect, because maybe by the mere fact of accelerating it, you're changing the conditions, and so you've introduced unknowns into the whole scientific process, if you will, of testing.
Are inspection technologies coming along and moving in the direction of helping us to detect incipient failures and lead us to better allocation of resources in the future?
Well, I definitely think new inspection technologies are going to help us detect insufficiencies and so forth. Whether they're going to help us make wiser, you know, public policy decisions, that I don't know. I'm not sure how increased technology is necessarily going to, you know, change the attitude of politics and politicians and states and federal government. That's another issue.
From your perspective, do you think that the, let me put it differently, are there ways that we can help the people involved in the policy process understand risk-benefit trade-offs and move in a direction of allocating resources in response to what those risks might be?
Well, certainly there can be, you know, attempts at education. Presumably these people are, you know, pretty bright and capable of understanding these things. But as I see what's happening in Washington these days, the debate is often at a different level. It's not at even sometimes it doesn't even appear to be at a rational level. it hinges so much on political advantage and political posturing that I if they do make risk benefit calculations, they're political ones. What is the political risk of doing this, or what's the political benefit of doing this? Seems to be more the mode that so many politicians have operated in, at least. Now, there some people think there's reason to hope that this is going to change, we shall see. But I think there are probably going to be rougher times before there are better times.
And when you imagine rougher times, what does that look like?
Oh, things breaking more than they have been for lack of attention to the infrastructure. Bridges, perhaps, important bridges being closed, or possibly even failing like the Minneapolis Bridge. The Minneapolis Bridge is not the only one that, you know, fell under interstate traffic. There have been other examples of that over the past few decades. So it's not a totally singular event, and it could obviously happen again. And it probably will. It's almost, I think, virtually impossible to predict exactly when or where it will happen. But it's very likely that it will. That'll be a wake-up call. There's a certain pattern to this. A bridge collapses, and there's a lot of attention paid to it. It's news. It's an unusual event. People usually are killed and injured. A lot of people are, you know, impacted by it. The subsequent traffic patterns are severely affected. That happened in San Francisco back in 1989. There was an earthquake that caused part of the San Francisco Oakland Bay Bridge to collapse. It was just a minor part of it. It's a big, long bridge, but it interrupted traffic for about 2 months. That made San Franciscans and the people around the Bay Area realize how important that bridge was to their daily lives. The California Transportation Department, Caltrans, it's called, after that incident, proposed that the bridge either be beefed up to withstand earthquakes, which are common around there, of course, or to build a new bridge. Now, this was, you know, back two decades ago. And their proposal was that it'll probably cost as much to fix it up as to just build a new bridge on the east side of the bay. And that's in the process now, but it's just encountered many, many delays. It's encountered many, many cost increases. And it doesn't give people, or technical people, not just lay people, the impression that this stuff is being done totally correctly. And that bridge has had some real problems in the meantime, and it's still under a great deal of discussion and controversy, especially about how it was going to be paid for, how it will be paid for. Are there further surprises? Is it going to get more and more expensive? And that's just one project in the country.
It is an interesting example because it is a full 21 years since the precipitating event, and they don't have a replacement bridge yet.
That's right. And these things move slowly sometimes. That's an extreme example, perhaps, but not that extreme.
And the most recent ASCE infrastructure report card, which came out in 2009, gave an overall grade of D to the nation's infrastructure. If you had been grading that, would you have given the same grade?
I think I'd have to give some more thought to that. There are committees. This is the American Society of Civil Engineers, and they have committees that look at subcategories like bridges or water supply or garbage collection and disposal. They have a whole series of categories. I think what they're trying to emphasize is that the infrastructure is in bad shape, and they issue this report about once every 3 years. And the grades have hovered, the average grade has hovered between D and D plus or D minus. I don't know if it's even gotten as high as D plus. I think they're trying to send a signal. It's probably the only way to get attention to such a big problem is to be dramatic about it. So there's this concept of a report card.
Is there anything other than failure? Because I know even if the politicians are enlightened and want to do things, they can only do it if they have the support of the public. Is there anything that moves the public to invest in infrastructure other than witnessing a catastrophic failure?
Well, I think education. I think, putting it in perspective, how did we get what we've got with the bridges and the roads, waterways? There's so much. It didn't just appear. It wasn't here when the country was declared the United States of America. It has taken a lot of public interest and public works, an attitude toward public works that it is for the common good, the betterment of the roads and so forth. Back in the early part of the 20th century, when the automobile was beginning to be used, the roads were terrible. It was not clear that a car could drive across country very, very easily at all. In fact, around the First World War, the Army sent a convoy out across the country I think it started in Washington or nearby and ended up somewhere near San Francisco. And it took a month, I believe, literally, to do that. And one of the people on that in that caravan was Dwight Eisenhower. And later, when he became president, decades later, it was that he realized from the conditions of the roads that he had seen that we really needed an interstate highway system, what came to be called an interstate highway system. And it was that experience, that direct experience that he had as a young soldier, that was very important in giving him this desire to give that a high priority, something that he would he would fight for. And obviously, it was very successful, and we all benefit from that today. But it cost a lot of money, and it took a lot of planning and a lot of patience. It started, I think, recently the interstate highway system celebrated its 50th anniversary.
I don't think we're in a position to give all of our future policymakers that kind of experience, but I wonder, in the field that you're in, that I'm in as well, do you feel we're doing enough to educate that next generation of engineers to be prepared to deal with these kinds of problems, the trade-offs between money and risk, new designs, and monitoring and managing this aging infrastructure?
Well, I certainly try to convey these things to my students. I teach a lot of case studies. I teach a lot about projects and try to emphasize that it's more than just a technical problem. It's a problem that has many facets, including money, including political will, and so forth. I think trying to communicate with the general public through lectures or being on the radio, for example, is a means of education that can help, I hope.
Well, it's something we're all working on together. Do you feel that we are learning all that we can and should learn from infrastructure failures?
Yes and no. I think there is a general sense that only recent events are important in technology. I've been a strong proponent for taking a much longer historical view. The case of suspension bridges, for example, is something I've studied and written and talked about a lot. The fact is that back in the early 18th century, 200 years ago, suspension bridges were failing at a very, very large rate, principally in the wind. The wind was blowing them, blowing down the roadway, the deck of the bridge. And this gave suspension bridges a bad reputation, not surprisingly. And in Britain, the response was to, well, just not build suspension bridges. And they took off in a whole technologically totally different direction. But there was an engineer in America named John Roebling, who was born in Europe, in Germany, came over to the United States in the 1830s. His great desire was to build suspension bridges that would stand up to the wind. So what he did is he studied all of the failure reports that he could find, and there were a lot of them. And he came to some pretty elementary conclusions that, you know, the wind was very much the enemy of suspension bridges, so he had to figure out how to build them to withstand high winds, and he did. And he went on to build some very famous bridges, including the Brooklyn Bridge. That was his design. He died before it really got started, but it was basically his design. In the course of then that was completed in 1883. Over the course of the next five, six or so decades, suspension bridges began to be built longer and longer, but at the same time, they began to be built lighter and lighter. And in 1940, there was a famous failure of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, which the wind brought down. That was about 100 years after Roebling was studying these failures. And the report that was issued of why the Tacoma Narrows Bridge collapsed was almost the same as Roebling had written 100 years earlier. In other words, just because something was done quite a ways back doesn't mean that it's not relevant to today's technology. And forgetting what the fundamental assumptions and fundamental understanding of how suspension bridges work and how they are affected by the wind, forgetting about that was the downfall of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. So a long historical view, I think, is very important because technology is always evolving. We're always changing the designs. We think we're making them better, and in many cases we are, but in some cases, some very important cases, we're forgetting some fundamental assumptions that were ingrained in the technology, and we only realize those things if we have a historical perspective.
So it's a very interesting way to put it, and it suggests to me that old saw that those who don't remember history are doomed to repeat it may well be true in engineering as well as in other parts of life. We appreciate your spending the time with us to educate us on the value, if you will, of failures and the risk of failures. We particularly appreciate your writing and speaking and your long career in education because of the contributions that you're making to ensure our infrastructure in the future. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.